The House Committee on Education will come to order. Welcome. Sorry for the late start this morning. We have a very varied agenda today. Just to give you a sense of how the day is going to go, it will be in the order that's listed on the agenda here, starting with an informational hearing and then the two public hearings. If you have a cell phone with you, please turn it off, not just to silent, but all the way off. It interferes with the recording equipment. And I am going to open an informational hearing on early childhood programs. Thank you. And Dr. Ross Thompson, please. And Dick Alexander. Yes. Thank you. Welcome. And other members will be floating in. There was a meeting just before this that ran over. So please introduce yourselves and welcome to the House Education Committee.
Thank you.
Thank you, Chairman Gelser. My name is Dick Alexander, and I'm the chair of the Ready for School campaign. We appear before you today to support the expansion of Head Start and the introduction of funding to early Head Start in Oregon. I'd like to introduce our special guest, Dr. Thompson. Dr. Thompson is a professor of psychology at the University of California, Davis, and a member of the National Scientific Council on the Developing Child. His work focuses on social-emotional development in the context of close personal relationships. He received the Boyd McCandless Award from the American Psychological Association and the Outstanding Research and Creative Activity Award from the University of Nebraska. He's spoken some here in Oregon before and is considered to be an expert source of information on early childhood intervention, particularly in neurological areas. He's produced from Neurons to Neighborhoods. I think some of us are familiar with the science of early childhood development. We welcome Dr. Fox to be with us. Dr. Thompson.
Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair and members of the committee, my name is Ross Thompson. I am a professor of psychology at the University of California at Davis and have been a long-term developmental research psychologist focused on early psychological development as it relates to brain maturation. And I'm here to talk with you about expansion of Head Start in Oregon and introduction of early Head Start. You'll find a brief outline of my comments in the packet of materials that you have before you. Research from a range of scientific disciplines provides us with a clear and convincing case for the critical importance of the early years to later success in school and in life. So here are some of the things that the science tells us. First of all, the development of essential human competencies is at its most accelerated pace in the early years, and it's based on processes of brain development. Quite simply, early development lays a foundation for all that follows. We see it most clearly in early brain development, when the nerve cells that will last a lifetime develop. Early experiences shape the connections between these nerve cells, and the brain becomes wired in ways that provide a foundation for the development of more advanced capacities in the years that follow. Secondly, the growth of these basic early competencies is directly linked to the emergence of adult skills that are important to success. This is true in many, many areas, from language ability to communication skills to problem solving and categorization to capacities for focusing attention and exercising self-control. In each case, early developing abilities are the foundation for the skills required for school readiness and for adult skills important to workplace success. Thirdly, and importantly, early learning is based on both cognitive and non-cognitive skills. Although we often focus on cognitive skills, the science tells us that non-cognitive skills, such as a child's curiosity, their motivation to learn, their self-confidence, excitement about new discovery, and the capacities to focus attention and get along well with others, are also important predictors of early learning success. Both cognitive and non-cognitive skills underlie school success, and children in socioeconomic hardship are likely to be lagging in both areas. Fourth, early experiences, both good and bad, are significant influences on brain development and psychological growth. Much of the story of early experience and brain development is focused on encouraging parents to talk, to read, to sing, and to play with their young children, which is very worthwhile. But the influence of early experience is a double-edged sword. It means that because many young children experience chronic stress, neglect, violence, and deprivation, these are also the major architects of their brain development. And this is one of the reasons that early deprivation and stress can have enduring, detrimental consequences for brain development, for psychological growth, and for physical health. It's also one of the reasons why the amount of childhood adversity experienced in the early years is an important predictor, not only of later life adult physical health, but also of adult mental health problems. Fifth, as brain circuits consolidate over time, the brain's plasticity decreases. What we mean by the brain's plasticity is its flexibility and its adaptability, and this flexibility naturally declines as brain architecture develops and consolidates. For many young children, however, this means that the brain is being built around early experiences of stress and trauma whose effects become more difficult to remediate over time. For this reason, it's biologically wiser to prevent many difficulties from emerging than to try to remediate problems once they have already developed, to put it somewhat differently. It's much easier to try to adjust the effects of early deprivation or trauma when children are young than to do so in someone my age, after all this has become consolidated and hardened. Sixth, the quality of early relationships is really the active ingredient in healthy brain growth and in psychological development. Nurturant, sensitive relationships provide the best catalyst to the healthy growth of minds and of brains. Supportive relationships also help to buffer the effects of early stress that can be a significant impediment to learning. It really makes a difference if children in adversity have supportive relationships. Seventh and finally, early intervention programs can improve developmental outcomes for children who are at risk of long-term difficulty, especially if the programs are carefully designed and thoughtfully implemented. One of the questions our panel addressed in the From Neurons to Neighborhoods volume was a question of, do we know what to do to intervene that can be effective in helping to improve the odds for at-risk young children? The answer of our committee was yes. And now, even since the days in which that volume was published, there has emerged a significant science of early intervention that shows in carefully designed studies involving randomized controls the long-term benefits to young children from their participation in high-quality early intervention programs. So I would argue that the science of early childhood development suggests that investing in early in young children makes a lot of sense, both biologically and economically, both for the opportunities provided by the early development of the brain and by the ease with which prevention efforts can be successful. I think this research has three further implications for our thinking about Head Start, which is associated with the Oregon Pre-K effort, and also early Head Start, which the legislature has an opportunity to inaugurate in this session for Oregon children. The first implication is that the most effective programs to support early brain growth and psychological development are those that pay attention to intellectual, social, and emotional development, and which support families and parenting beginning early in life. This follows from what we know about the importance of both cognitive and non-cognitive skills and the significance of early relationships to early learning. It is also consistent with what we know about the conditions of young children in socioeconomic hardship, who not only fall behind in letter and number skills, but are also often lacking in physical health, the motivation to succeed, and supportive relationships at home. Importantly, the Head Start program that is already established here in Oregon has all of these essential components of effective early intervention for at-risk young children. Early Head Start offers the opportunities to build on this foundation by starting early, and it combines exactly these same effectiveness tools in programs specifically tailored for infants and toddlers. Another implication of this research is that the results of rigorous research in the evaluation literature are documenting the benefits of Head Start and early Head Start for enhancing children's progress in school readiness, in developing supportive parent-child relationships, and in improved family functioning. The congressionally mandated randomized controlled trial, in particular of early Head Start, has documented significant positive impacts on standardized measures of children's cognitive and language development, as well as measures of supportive family relationships and increased family self-sufficiency. Finally, in relation to the number of children at risk, both in Oregon and nationally, the science of early childhood development suggests that investment in Head Start and early Head Start is warranted. Developmentally appropriate early childhood education looks a lot different than developmentally appropriate education for young children. Early Head Start is a developmentally appropriate program for young children. The enhanced participation of eligible young children in a well-designed program like this one respects our growing awareness of the importance of the early years for brain development and for psychological growth. In many respects, Oregon has made a fantastic beginning in the expansion of funding for Head Start in the last legislative session. Ensuring and expanding that strong foundation for Oregon's children and complementing it with the opportunities to begin earlier in early Head Start is a fantastic way to consider building on this foundation in the current session. Thank you very much. I'd be happy to respond to questions or to provide any further information for you.
Thank you very much. Are there any questions?
Well,
I'm waiting.
Representative Van Orman has to have something.
That's why I'm looking down here.
Well, I thank you because I considered it a privilege to work with Head Start for 22 years. And I miss it. And I thank you for the compliments. Because, as I said, I was very privileged to work with it, and I really felt that we did work for the goals and for the children and the families. And I am one of the people who was involved in writing the legislation in 1987 that specifically ensured that we allied the Oregon Head Start program with the federal performance standards, because we strongly believed in the model and we strongly believed in the parent involvement piece.
Yes.
So thank you for coming, and thank you for enforcing the work that we do.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Springer. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure it's in here, and I'm scrambling to find it. What are the ages that you serve in Head Start? I'm familiar with Head Start, but what are the ages you serve in Head Start, and what are the ages you serve in early Head Start, or how are those differentiated?
Head Start, Madam Chair, Representative Springer, Head Start is typically oriented toward preschoolers, generally 4 to 5. Early Head Start is an infant-toddler program.
Okay.
And so early Head Start, we're essentially getting an early intervention for very much the same kind of population.
Thank you.
May I follow up?
Yes.
May I follow up?
Yes, Representative Van Orman.
Actually, in Oregon, they're serving pregnant women to 3 in early Head Start and 3 to 5 in Head Start in Oregon.
There are further questions. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
And thanks so much for coming. So I'm going to close the informational hearing on early childhood programs and open a public hearing on House Bill 2756. Kevin, can you give us an outline of the bill, please?
Thank you, Chairman Gelser, members of the committee. Before you is House Bill 2756. This is a measure that proposes to create a necessary scholarship with respect to early, scholarship program with respect to foreign languages. It proposes to allow up to $2,000 scholarships for individuals who show advancement with respect to foreign languages. Furthermore, those scholarships can be continued provided that there is sufficient development that continues in speaking, writing, and also written proficiency with respect to the language. It also creates a necessary trust fund for grants and appropriations that are made with respect to the scholarship program.
Thank you. And Representative Comp and Claire Bloomberg, please. Okay, welcome.
Hi. For the record, my name is Representative Betty Comp, and I serve House District 22, which is North Salem, Jervis, Brooks, and Woodburn. And today is my honor to come to testify and give you a little bit of an overview, but I have obviously a special witness that can give her perspective on this bill. But in respect to Representative Buckley and Bailey, that's our co-sponsors of this bill, this is an issue that's dear to many of our hearts about having the opportunity for students to become fluent in more than one language. And part of that beginning and promise for us to have a world-class education system in Oregon, also to have a world-class workforce in Oregon. And it is my honor today to have it's pretty exciting for me because I have to deviate just a little bit. Working in Woodburn School District since 1990 has been an opportunity, a growing experience, and one that has shown me the strengths and the challenges that we have in our education system. But what we have in our midst is the opportunity for all of our students to learn two languages or to be fluent in two languages. And with Claire today is one of our school principals, Sherilyn Rawson, who is just one of the inspirational leaders that I've had the opportunity to work with. And so, but with that, I think Claire's presentation will speak for herself on this, and that if you have any other questions, Principal Rawson is here to help us out. So I'm going to stay and be a little bit of support with Claire also. And her parents are here too. Go ahead, Claire.
Hola, me llamo Claire. Estoy en el quinto grado programa dual en la escuela Nelly Muir Primaria en Woodburn. Hello, my name is Claire. I'm in the fifth grade dual program in Nelly Muir Elementary School in Woodburn. And when I grow up, I would like to be a dermatologist, so I'm going to be studying chemistry when I go to college. I think it's really good to know a foreign language because, especially if somebody wants to be a doctor, they could go to other countries to help people, or they can understand their patients if they speak a foreign language. I really like knowing two languages. It makes me feel really proud of myself. And at first when my mom said I had to be in the dual program, I thought I wouldn't like it because I thought I wouldn't be able to understand anything. Or learn anything. But I'm glad she put me in the program. I think you should really pass this bill. Thank you. If you have any questions, I can answer in English or Spanish.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Parker.
Mucho gusto, señorita, y gracias por venir aquí a hablar con nosotros.
De nada.
Tienes un acento casi perfecto.
Gracias.
Mm-hmm. Now, can you translate for us?
I wasn't going to.
I think he was being complimentary.
He said that, he said thank you for coming and talking today, and he also said that I have an almost perfected accent.
Weaving in. Representative Maurer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll speak English.
Come on, don't be bad. Hey, I put myself out there. Come on.
Well, sprechen Sie Deutsch?
Nein.
Dermatologist is great, but you don't have to go to a foreign country. You can come to Southern Oregon, and we'll have a spot for you.
Yeah.
That's it.
Thank you. Are there further comments or questions for this panel? Thank you so much. Claire, thank you for coming. Representative Van Orman.
No.
Oh, it's...
She yields to me once again.
Yes,
no, really, truly, you're very lucky to have done this at your age, and your parents are to be commended, as you said. It will serve you well throughout your life, no matter what you decide to do.
Okay.
Congratulations, and go for it.
Thank you.
Chair, yes, could I ask you the committee's indulgence to have Principal Ross describe the dual language in her school?
Mm-hmm. Of course. Thank you. Welcome.
Thank you. Madam Chair, members of the committee, very briefly, the program that we have at Nellie Muir, my name is Sherilyn Rawson. I'm the principal at Nellie Muir Elementary School in the Woodburn School District. The program that we have at Nellie Muir is a dual immersion program, and that means that we have students who speak different languages at home working together, learning different languages together. And so in kindergarten and first grade, 80% of the instructional day is in Spanish and 20% of the day is in English, and more English is added until at Claire's level in fourth and fifth grade, 50% of the day is in Spanish and 50% of the day is in English. And as you can tell, she's quite competent in both languages. What did you just finish reading in your English literacy?
My ELB teacher, Mr. Aniguez, assigned us kind of difficult books, and I just finished reading Mary Shelley's Frankenstein.
So their literacy skills are quite high in English as well as in Spanish, and we're seeing some tremendous results and success with the students who've been in the program. And I would like to thank the state of Oregon, who recognized our school as a continuing success school in 2008, recognized us as a closing the achievement gap school in 2006, and was one of two schools to receive the Distinguished Title I Schools Award this year in 2009. And that was thank you very much to the state of Oregon and the Department of Education for that recognition.
Thank you. Are there further questions? This panel? Thank you, Representative Comp. Thank you, Claire. Thank you, Principal. Thank you. Our next panel is Colin Crocker.
I lived in Mexico as a kid.
Welcome.
Thank you.
And I understand you're doing the warm-up act for the next panel of three.
Oh, boy, yes. Yes, I am. Well, good afternoon, and thank you for allowing me some time to come here and speak to you today. My name is Colin Crocker, and I am a public policy analyst at the University of Oregon Center for Applied Second Language Studies, and I'm currently working on a project called the Oregon Roadmap to Language Excellence. So I'd like to give you a bit of background on how House Bill 2756 was developed and why it's important for Oregon's future. This bill is an outcome of the Oregon Roadmap to Language Excellence process. The goal of this process was to assess the need for foreign language skilled employees in Oregon and then address this demand with locally created policy solutions. In the spring of 2007, the roadmap team conducted 80 separate interviews assessing demand in both the public and private sectors. The key findings of this interview process were as follows. We discovered a definite unmet need for employees with professional foreign language skills. This need is universal. Small business and public sector needs tend to reflect the socio-demographic composition of Oregon. Spanish, Russian, and Korean seem to be the most needed languages. Larger and medium-sized enterprises like Nike, IBM, Columbia Sportswear, and CH2M Hill emphatically stated there was no one specific language they were seeking. This was surprising, as we expected Chinese to dominate demand. Essentially, these businesses value all languages when paired with a professional skill or expertise. Excuse me. Next, the roadmap engaged local stakeholders who participated in the assessment process to develop public policy supply-side initiatives designed to address the demand. Over the course of 3 months in the summer of 2007, Roadmap Task Force groups met, exchanging ideas, brainstorming, and creating solutions. 13 key proposals came out of this process, some requiring legislative action and others calling for partnerships between nonprofits and the public and private sectors. It is important to note that none of the 14 proposals require mandatory action. Instead, they focus on providing incentives. House Bill 2756 is an outcome of this process. This bill establishes a higher education scholarship program designed to reward foreign language proficiency. As the bill states, proficiency testing is done at the beginning and end of each academic year. For every measurable gain in proficiency acquired, the student is rewarded. Any student exhibiting an intermediate mid-level of foreign language proficiency is encouraged to apply. Scholarships will not be awarded to students who exhibit skills beyond superior low, as this level of foreign language skill should allow them to excel in the workplace. The scholarship is for students wishing to expand their education beyond high school. whether that be a job training program at a community college or an undergraduate degree at a traditional four-year institution in Oregon. The proficiency metric used is the American Council for the Teaching of Foreign Language Proficiency Scale. This metric is well known and widely accepted. The assessment tool would be Stamp, Noella, or another similarly well-known assessment tool. By offering incentives to continually improve developing foreign language skills, House Bill 2756 is an appropriate investment into Oregon's ability to compete in an increasingly globalizing world. It is a locally designed solution created to meet increasingly global demands. Clearly, English will remain an important language in an ever-flattening world. However, as recent market trends have indicated, this will also include a critical mix of other languages as well. Positioning our graduates to succeed in this new world is absolutely essential. House Bill 2756, if passed, will certainly play a major role in meeting the demand for professionally proficient foreign language skilled employees in Oregon. To quote Greg Borisay, the general manager of liner development at the Port of Portland, the supply of skilled foreign language employees is critical to the future economic success in Oregon. The Port of Portland values these employees because proficiency in a foreign language brings not only the language ability itself, but also the cultural understanding that is so important in furthering the port's business marketing goals and objectives. I urge the committee to carefully consider the merits of House Bill 2756. I thank the committee for their time and am open to any questions.
Thank you very much. Are there questions? If not, yes, Representative Van Orman.
Yes. Thank you, Chair Gelser. On your interview findings, you have identified Spanish, Russian, and Korean. Spanish, I understand. In Russian, I'm presuming it's because of the predominance of Russians that are living in this area. Is that a correct assumption?
Correct, yeah.
Okay.
Are there further questions? Representative Parker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So that, your answer to that question suggests that this is for training for people to work with local populations, more so than to go abroad and extend Oregon-based or other U.S.-based businesses into other countries.
Correct, but I feel that the need for Oregon graduates to be able to compete with graduates from other states for jobs here or abroad is absolutely critical.
Mm-hmm.
Ideally, Oregon-created solutions would keep Oregon graduates in Oregon working for great Oregon companies, but it doesn't need to be that way, too. So.
Or elsewhere in the world working
exactly.
For Oregon companies.
Right. Yeah, sure.
Okay, thanks.
Thank you, Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I'm reading out of this pamphlet.
Okay.
I'm assuming you were instrumental in.
Yes, sir.
Okay. Oregon spends $80 million a year on foreign language instruction, yet only an estimated 5% of native English-speaking high school graduates and 20% of college graduates reach functional proficiency. My question is, we have a foreign language requirement. It's an expectation in high school to take foreign language. Is there a value in taking a foreign language if you're doing it for a couple years and you have no expectation of becoming proficient, or are you just wasting your time?
In my opinion, I would say that the value of taking that 2 years of seat time that's generally done in high school, the value there is cultural awareness and exposure, maybe some very basic beginning skills. Beyond that, quite honestly, I'm a product of Oregon schools, and I took 2 years of French in Roseburg, and my French is non-existent today, almost 20 years later. I think that longer sequences of foreign languages are definitely much more valuable.
Yeah, and Madam Chair, just a follow-up. I took 3 years of high school German, took a semester or a term at Oregon State of German, and know next to nothing other than conversational stuff that I know from home.
Sure.
Thank you, Representative Van Orman.
Well, thank you, Chair Gelser. That raises another question for me because I, too, have the same experience. 2 years high school, 2 years of college, actually, and I in Spanish. And I probably have a vocabulary of a three-year-old.
which works in my former profession. But having said that, does that mean that the teaching approach has changed? Because I think one of the key factors missing is the ability to converse regularly in the language you're learning. Is that instruction changed in that regard?
Pedagogy is not my strong point.
Okay.
Public policy really is, but I can tell you from what I've learned, yes, the teaching approach has changed. It's gone from teaching primarily a grammar-based model of drilling students in grammar to some in-context language learning, some Bible study abroad experiences, use of technology. So, yes, I think it is changing.
Okay.
It should change, in my opinion.
Yes, because I think we're an example of the other one didn't work.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you. And I think our next panel is Mark Sansui, Sarah Howell, and Paul Premick. Hi. Welcome.
Hi there, Chairwoman Gelser. Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak to you today on behalf of House Bill 2756. My name is Sarah Howell. I live in Lake Oswego, Oregon, and as a parent of two young children who are not yet in kindergarten, I'm very grateful to the people at the Center for Applied Second Language Studies who work every day for quality foreign language programs in our public schools. I believe that in this global economy, it's important that every child in Oregon have a chance to be proficient in a second language. Over the last year and a half, I've been involved in an effort to persuade my community, Lake Oswego School District, to offer foreign language immersion programs. We've circulated a community petition which now has 125 families on it. All of these parents are asking the school district to offer language immersion programs in primary grades and give our kids a chance to benefit from a bilingual education. My oldest child, Charlie, is now preschool age, and we're considering several of the language immersion programs in the Portland metro area. I want my children to have what I didn't have as a student in Westland Wilsonville School District, a real opportunity to become proficient in a foreign language. Experts agree the most effective way to do this is through significant exposure to the foreign language before age 12. A common program model is foreign language immersion. In an immersion classroom, at least 50% of the curriculum is delivered in a child's non-native language. Research shows, and I think the girl that was just here also showed, that language immersion programs drive academic achievement and often cost no more than regular programs to deliver. Now, school districts can be wary of change, and I often hear concerns from district leaders about implementing such a program in the current economy. I believe that scholarships such as this one would provide another incentive for school districts to offer programs that focus on language excellence. More districts need to provide our kids with an innovative global curriculum such as language immersion programs. Fluency in more than one language is a crucial step towards preparing kids to succeed in a global economy. And Oregon's not the only state that has work to do with foreign language instruction in public schools. In fact, the United States is behind other countries in offering foreign language education. More than 50% of Europeans fluently speak a second language, but only 9% of U.S. adults are fluent in a second language. In this era of globalization, people across the world are competing on a more level playing field. I believe that the difference between success and failure will be the ability to communicate and understand. Second language skills allow students to be productive citizens in an increasingly interdependent world. Offering the Oregon Roadmap to Language Excellence Scholarship Fund will reward hardworking students and encourage further study. On behalf of our children and the global community with which they will soon engage, I urge you to vote yes on House Bill 2756. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay.
Chairman Gelser and members of the committee. My name is Paul Primack. I'm the director for the Oregon University System International Programs and International Internships Operation. We're based at Oregon State University, and I'm delighted to be here to testify on behalf of this bill. Oregon's economy, as you well know, is based upon our citizens' ability to produce, trade, innovate, and communicate. Our ability to communicate with and understand other cultures is essential to our economic development and public diplomacy. I come before you today in support of this bill to help underscore the importance of studying languages in primary and secondary schools and to reward those students who do so with supplementary financial incentives. While financial capital is in short supply these days, we can't afford to shortchange our future human capital. Through the scholarship program, which builds upon the significant work of the Center for Applied Language Studies at the University of Oregon and the many contributing organizations and individuals who helped develop the Oregon Roadmap to Language Excellence, we have an opportunity to promote and reward second language study. Through the benefits of this legislation, I can imagine teachers, students, and parents in our primary and secondary schools realizing not only the inherent benefits of second language study, but also the financial benefits as students move into the higher education environment. I and my colleagues who teach languages in our universities can imagine the benefits and advantages of students who come to our universities better prepared, more advanced in a second or even possibly third language. I can also imagine sending better prepared language students on international programs and international internships and the benefits that will accrue to our state. With this legislation, we have an opportunity to create opportunities for students, opportunities to build partnerships with K through 12 and higher education. We have an opportunity to develop a workforce that can work in and understand different cultures as insiders. Finally, we have an opportunity to build on the very successful work of the Oregon Roadmap and demonstrate Oregon's commitment to participating in the global marketplace and producing graduates from our educational system who are capable of working in that workplace. Thanks for this opportunity to offer this testimony, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you. Chair Gelser and committee, thank you for allowing me the opportunity to speak with you today. I am Mark Sansusi, the Department of Defense Regional Liaison for Military Families for the Northwest, and Oregon is my responsibility up here in the Northwest. And I'm here today to express Department of Defense support for HB 2756, the Oregon Roadmap to Language Excellence Scholarship Bill to reward and encourage foreign language proficiency. Given time constraints, I'd like to emphasize a few key points. The Department of Defense considers satisfying foreign language requirements as one of our top 10 key issues for the quality of life of our military families. We would like more of our families to be like Claire, who you met on the first panel. Foreign language proficiency is critical to the ability of the United States to meet its security and its economic objectives. Working with state policymakers, we seek to encourage the states to work with their business and education sectors to develop foreign language roadmaps which meet their requirements as well as assist in meeting strategic national security and economic objectives in our era of globalization. The Department of Defense has funded the National Security Education Program known as NSEP, which, and you heard from Colin Crocker, that's who he works with, seeking to build a broader and more qualified pool of U.S. citizens with foreign language and international skills. NSEP focuses on the critical languages of Africa, Asia, Eastern Europe, Latin America, and the Middle East. In tandem with President Bush's 2006 National Strategic Language Initiative, NSEP represents the Department of Defense in this presidential initiative with a commitment to encourage states to develop the language roadmaps and flagship universities that come with it. These roadmaps, like the Oregon Roadmap to Language Excellence, which Colin just made reference to, would retool the state's K through 16 education systems to increase proficiency in strategic languages which meet the state's requirements, as well as assisting in meeting our national defense and economic security objectives.
Currently, the Department of Defense, through NSEP, has successfully worked with states to establish 17 flagship universities to develop advanced language curricula in strategic languages. The University of Oregon is one of the flagship universities with its renowned Chinese Center. In addition, prototype K through 16 education pipelines include the Portland Public School K through 12 flagship program, and it includes that program. NSEP has funded and facilitated development of state-level roadmaps for strategic languages in Ohio, Oregon, and Texas. Oregon is one of the leader of the PAC states in our view on this issue. We think that HB 2756 to establish language excellence scholarships is a first step and one of the few efforts, actually the first effort nationwide, that aligns with the roadmap effort, and Colin Crocker is talking about the NSEP program. And we ask for your support and keep Oregon in the forefront as a leading edge state on strategic languages by passing 2756. Thank you.
Thank you. Are there questions for this panel? Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. As you might guess, I'm a strong proponent of this kind of thing. I wonder, reading the bill here quickly as I've tried to do, if it has another impact, which is to become a scholarship for people who are already they're not first language English speakers. And certainly those folks should have access to all sorts of scholarships. But I'm not, maybe I've misread or I'm reading something into it that's not here, but certainly people have thought about this more than I have. Am I missing something? Can someone clearly say, Harker, you're off base?
Can I speak to that?
Yes. You need to come to the table and then reintroduce yourself for the record, please.
Again, my
Thank
name
you.
Is Colin Crocker. I think that that's true. Yeah, I think that the idea that all U.S. Citizens or folks who are here legally have legal status here would be eligible for the scholarship appropriately. Yeah.
Representative Maurer.
Thanks, Madam Chair. My question is, would we rather have, and this, I think, Mr. Sanusi, the question is to you, would you rather have 60-70% of the students have 2 years of two or 3 years of a foreign language and be completely improficient or not proficient, or would you rather have 10% of the students be very proficient?
10% of the students being very proficient, and I remember when you asked that earlier. The goal of the strategic language roadmaps is eventually K through 16, so we would get them early and throughout, so we would have very proficient Claires out there. So, yes, sir.
Thank you. Representative Dimbrough.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And actually, just following up on those two comments and questions. Actually, first of all, let me say, you know, I'm a very strong proponent of foreign language coming as quickly as possible for students. You know, they're getting it at a young age. My experience is that if a student has learned a foreign language at a young age, it becomes much easier for them to learn further foreign languages. There seems to be something about the brain that just where that happens. And so, you know, I really like the idea of immersion programs. I think it's really important. You know, I think that the foreign language requirements need to be increased in this state in general for all students. And one of my disappointments from my time on the State Board of Education was that as we were enhancing graduation requirements, we were very tepid on foreign languages. One thing that I would like to see in this program is while it encourages students to come to college having reached a degree of proficiency in a foreign language, I'd really like to see it incentivize students who are continuing to learn foreign language. I mean, that's something that the Defense Department used to do very aggressively, I think more aggressively than they do now, you know, is to support students through college and into the graduate level. Actually, my first year of graduate school, I supported myself with a work-study job typing Russian, which was very interesting. I just wonder if the bill is really going to accomplish that. That is, it's going to keep students studying language and reaching a higher, real levels of proficiency while they're in college.
The bill does actually speak to that. It, for every level of proficiency gained that we can measure, scholarship funding is available for the next year of study. So that would require a assessment test in the beginning of that year, and then at the end of that academic year to be eligible for funding for the next year. So I think it does that while it's in school. I think what you're also talking about here is support career, basically finding a career, that kind of support maybe after school. Is that correct?
Yeah, well, actually, even the first one. So a student would be reassessed each year of college,
yes.
And they would have had to reach X amount of higher proficiency than in order to get this, to keep the scholarship?
Correct, yeah, to be eligible for the next year of scholarship funding. Now, if a student does take the proficiency test and they're at intermediate mid, let's say, they don't quite reach intermediate high, we're not going to punish them for trying to reach that. We're still going to award them for the next year, but it will be less. And that's only a one-time and you're done deal. So if you don't increase on the next test after that, then you would be out. But yeah, the idea here is to keep increasing foreign language proficiency all through school.
And Representative Dembo, I did take your point about the Defense Department. I think in this bill, given the political and the fiscal realities, this was looked at as what was most feasible right now, but those are very viable points that maybe in the future we can explore.
Thank you very much. Thank you all very much. Oh, Representative Huffman.
Thank you. Probably for Colin. I'm not sure where this came from. On page 2, section 5, lines 4 and 5, the commission may not award scholarships under this section to a student who is enrolled in course study required for and leading to a degree in theology, divinity, or religious education. That strikes me as odd. Why would that be I'm getting that echo again. I just find that odd, knowing how a lot of times military chaplains or pastors are involved in communities, and priests, for example, in the Hispanic communities are very involved in guiding their parishioners into everything from business to social programs and whatnot. Can you explain that to me?
Actually, I found that very curious, too, after I received the draft of the bill myself. And I posed that question to Dana Richardson here at the state, and she said that that's standard language for scholarship-type bills. So,
follow-up, Madam Chair. Something to follow up on. Yes.
Yeah.
Okay. I guess connected with the funding source then, I guess, and I'm not saying I agree with it, but I guess I could see that if somebody has a problem with that because we're using tax monies to do it. But because the funding situation isn't the funding mechanism for this, an endowment or some type of a fund that's not being directed from tax dollars necessarily? I guess my question would be, how are we paying for this? Maybe that's the question.
That is the question.
That is the question.
We don't have an answer for you today.
Okay, and because Representative Comp and I was talking, and I didn't know if it was going to try to be done in an endowment situation since we didn't have tax dollars, or so maybe that.
Okay. I think we have lots of opportunities
for
the discussion. Thank you. I had one question quickly. On page 1, line 12, it says, has received a diploma from a high school in the state. So I was looking for some clarification around the idea that anyone that's legally here would be eligible for the scholarship. Would that be limited only to Oregon graduates?
Yes. Our feeling is that it would be only for Oregon graduates, yeah.
Thank you very much. Are there any further questions, Representative Dimbrough?
I do. Actually, I have a question for Paul. In your experience, and I don't know if you've tracked this at all, but how do the students doing international programs who are coming from Oregon high schools compare to those who are graduates from other state high schools? I mean, do you see any pattern in terms of the foreign language proficiency of Oregon graduates as opposed to other states?
Yeah. Chairman Gelser and Representative Dimbrough, no, we really haven't tracked that. I could say anecdotally that we don't see any real difference there. I think it's a pretty even score across the board.
Equally bad.
I wouldn't say equally good.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Our next panel is Robert Wilner and Scott Mattoon.
Actually, I don't think Scott, excuse me, is giving testimony.
Oh, all right. Is that true? Whoever? I don't. Okay, perfect. So, Robert Wilner, please. Thank you.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm Bob Wilner, Executive Director of the Oregon International Council, a nonprofit organization established in 1983 to try to strengthen the international dimension of Oregon education. I came to that position after 25 years in the U.S. Foreign Service, which persuaded me that the most serious problem our nation has in the world is at home, with the lack of global perspective that is so widely evident in our young people and middle-aged and older. And working with the International Council to try to shift that a little bit, I think we've had some success. I don't know how much. It's hard to measure. I spent 15 years of that past 25 also as Executive Secretary of the Oregon Language Teaching Association, which I found an interesting process, all of which leads me to support this bill very strongly as a step in the right direction. There are many other steps that need to be taken, I think, to broaden the perspectives of our nation as a whole, and especially the younger generation is going to have a worldwide context very much around their necks and better be aware of it. I was concerned about, and I think this bill is a fine idea. There's just one element that stuck in my mind, though, that I would like to propose, and that is that the demonstrates proficiency in language other than English. It probably needs to be backed up with a specific assessment. And I'd like to emphasize what I think is probably most people recognize here, but maybe not, that proficiency is not a yes-no subject. It's a dimension to be measured, and there are good ways of measuring it. And I think that the discussion we just heard indicates that they're well-established and well-recognized, but I think a lot of people still use the word proficiency rather in offhand fashion and don't realize how much variation it represents. In the Foreign Service, we had five levels, where one was able to handle courtesies and greetings and simple directions. Three was professionally competent, able to do the business of the Foreign Service in the target language. Five was, quote, indistinguishable from a well-educated native speaker. That's pretty rare, but it happens. And I understand that the ACTFL system is attuned to the slightly lower levels, but it's a good one. And the Oregon University system has developed some useful variations on it. But I just want to emphasize that I think it is important to have some measurement of a established on an established basis, and that's the point I wanted to make. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for coming today. I appreciate it. Are there any quick questions for this witness? No, thank you. Our last witness on this bill is Dennis Johnson from OSAC, please. Welcome.
Good afternoon again. Welcome. Thank you, Representative Gelser, members of the committee. For the record, I'm Dennis Johnson, Executive Director of the Student Assistance Commission, and we would be charged with implementing this scholarship should it become statute. Officially, of course, once again, you've heard me say this before, it's not in the governor's recommended budget, so we have an official position against the bill. Personally, I find this to be a very high priority. I certainly think it does provide some much-needed incentive, and I want to reassure you that it is certainly something that is doable, that it can be implemented, and perhaps I can answer some questions about the mechanics of that. Just to give you a little bit more background, I was, before coming here 3.5 years ago, vice president of a graduate school. It was an international graduate school where all of our students spoke at least two languages. Over 30% of them came from other countries, and I myself have extensive experience living and working overseas. What I found in higher education, and certainly this is from the undergraduate through the graduate level, is that American students need not just to learn other languages in a classroom setting, but also experience traveling, working, experience over broad, actually immersing them in other countries, in other cultures. I certainly found myself later on envying my daughter, who was able to go live and work in Japan and really learn the language that I had picked up and could get by with on the street. But she learned it. She lived it. And that's what it takes, particularly in difficult languages. Never even attempted Russian. It's so difficult. You know, you just learn the words and I know to say dos vidanya, but, you know, I really couldn't get by. In other countries, I could get by, and I would wager that even Mr. Crocker, who was here earlier and talked about his 2 years of high school French, drop him in a Francophile country, and he would know, or he would pick up right away, it would come back to him, it's not the time of day to say bonjour, it's now bonsoir, and he would know if he had studied a little bit of German. A few hours from now, it is no longer Guten Tag, it's Guten Abend, and those things do come back to you. So, like all education, it has potential to be built on and should not be wasted. I should mention that the language in the bill that Representative Dembro brought up about the religious exemption, that's boilerplate language that the Legislative Council left in this bill. It's in our statute, the Oregon Student Assistance Commission statute, for our need-based programs. We run 400 some other private scholarships, of course. We don't have language applying similarly to those programs, and it could be changed for this one, but once again, it's boilerplate. It's just the way things are right now. So what I find HB 2756 to be, it's a very good start. We would need to do some work on the assessment component, of course, because just grades on a transcript are not enough. But we recently have a lot of experience with electronic transcripts, and even though there are no standardized high school transcripts nor college transcripts in Oregon, we can accept them in virtually any form, whether it's an uploaded PDF or a batch of high school transcripts or college transcripts. So our first step, if we were implementing this program, would be to work with an advisory group. And I, in closing, just want to assure you that it is very doable and, again, one of those that in my heart I certainly support.
Thank you very much. Representative Huffman.
Madam Chair, just to take Representative Denver off the hook because I didn't want him tagged with a comment that
we're
I had made.
We're two peas in a pod.
Okay, all right. I just wanted to clarify.
Thank you very much. And thank you, Representative Kopp, for bringing such an interesting bill. I know that we will have further discussions on this. There's clearly a lot of interest and questions from our committee. So thank you all very much. And with that, I will close the public hearing on House Bill 2756 and open a public hearing on House Bill 2834. So, colleagues, you'll note on the agenda that House Bill 2834 has a special note underneath it. The bill itself was drafted to create a task force to look at the Oregon School for the Blind. And after about 25 or 30 years of many, many task forces, discussion groups, boards and organizations, it probably does not make sense to have another task force for the Oregon School for the Blind, which is why you see on the relating clause for this bill is relating to the Oregon School for the Blind. And on the agenda, you will note that this is for the purpose of discussing potential amendments regarding the closure of the Oregon School for the Blind. So if the legislature does choose to close the School for the Blind during the course of this legislative session, this is likely to be the vehicle through which that will be done. And so today is the first part of continuing a conversation that we began a couple of weeks ago. I wanted to walk you through some of the materials that you'll find at your space, and I brought a couple more, which I will offer to Kevin to distribute. You will find questions that were asked. We had several hours of hearings related to this issue a couple of weeks ago, and over the course of that 3 days, if you'll remember, it started on Monday. We went and spent a couple of hours at the Oregon School for the Blind. On Wednesday, we had an afternoon and an evening hearing, which probably compromised 5 to 6 hours of testimony about the experiences of those who are intimately connected to the Oregon School for the Blind. And that week on Friday, we also heard from some students around the state who are blind or visually impaired who are receiving services through their regional programs, although we also heard from a young woman who was enrolled at Chemeketa Community College who had previously received services through that. So in the course of that process, we asked a whole series of questions, and here is some information that the Department of Education has compiled for us. A couple of the questions that were asked that I would just highlight for us in terms of the age of the students who are there, 87% of the students currently attending the School for the Blind will age out of eligibility for that service within the next 3 years. We had asked questions about accreditation. The School for the Blind had lost its accreditation back in the early 1990s, and it's around that time that the school stopped offering academic programs. There had been some questions and testimony about benchmark data, and currently none of the students at the School for the Blind are meeting any of the state benchmarks. The other piece of material that you should have in front of you is the beginning of a framework for principles for looking at if we were to move forward with the closure process, what the principles for that would be, and I believe there's some extra copies in the back, in the rack. Is that true, Kevin? The extra
I'm
copies?
Sorry.
Did the extra copies of this go back into the rack?
We hand them over to Debbie.
Right. They're headed to the rack. And so this is just a draft of thinking, which I wanted to walk through quickly, and then we'll open it up for testimony and discussion of the committee. But these are principles for closure planning for the Oregon School for the Blind. And again, to be clear, this is a discussion only about the Oregon School for the Blind. This is not a discussion about the Oregon School for the Deaf. I know that's confusing because of the ongoing discussions about co-location. And at this point in history, really the two paths in terms of the future are co-location of the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf, or closure of the school for the blind and ongoing operation of the school for the deaf. The superintendent of public instruction has the authority to co-locate the schools, and she has already made that decision. That is not a legislative decision. So that will happen regardless of what this committee decides, unless the committee determines and the legislature determines to close the school for the blind. So in that process, these planning principles broadly are the needs of kids come first, that if there were to be a closure, that each student that is currently enrolled at the School for the Blind would have a comprehensive transition plan that would include resources for transition to their local community. These would include both educational resources and resources from the Department of Human Services. You'll see on the list they include things like training and staff development for the district, assistive technology, ongoing funds to maintain one-on-one support in the local school district if that's what's appropriate, funded summer or short-term residential camp or O&M orientation and mobility training opportunities, behavior support, and then priority access to necessary services through DHS, including things like respite care, in-home support, developmental disability eligibility determination and services, expedited enrollment in STALEY services, and foster placement as necessary. I think the principles would also include transition planning for staff. We're clearly in the midst of a very difficult economy, and we would want to do our best to assist those staff members in finding positions in the state of Oregon and hopefully in this local community for next school year if the School for the Blind was not in operation for the next school year. And then also preserving the financial commitment and improving services to children with blind, visual impairment, and multiple disabilities. And this part is important. This is not a discussion about saving money. This is a discussion about best deploying resources to best serve children with these disabilities. So the operation funds in this discussion would be preserved. They wouldn't get dumped back into the state school fund or even into the regional programs. They would be a separate and distinct fund that could be, in the first biennium, used, of course, to fund the successful transition of each of those students. And then any leftover funds from that and in future years would be maintained to support the technology needs, the staffing and personnel development needs, education needs of these students birthed through the age of 21. In terms of any sale of the property, the proceeds of that sale of the property under these principles would be held in trust for the benefit of children with blindness or visual impairments, and it would be overseen by a board of directors. And that board of directors would include members representing the blind community, the Oregon Department of Education, the developmental disability community, regional programs, local school districts, and at least one educator with an endorsement to teach blind, visually impaired, and multiply disabled children, and at least one member of that board would need to be a person that experienced blindness or that was blind. And again, that the funds would be held in trust for the benefit of these students and only for that use, and this board would oversee those distributions. But the purpose of the expenditures, again, would be the purchase of assistive technology and other equipment, which would improve the independence of students in daily living skills and in academics, to fund tuition for short-term residential programs to focus on orientation and mobility training, independent living skills and work and employment skills, and professional development for educators serving students who are blind and visually impaired. And in fact, a lot of this aligns with some of the long-range goals that were listed by the Oregon School for the Blind's Board of Directors in terms of the resources that needed to be offered statewide. And then finally, some of the funds could be used to implement a comprehensive vision screening program for all five-year-olds in public schools to make sure that we are maintaining the visual health and identifying early on students with vision impairment and getting to them the appropriate services and supports to make sure that they are able to make best possible use of their functional vision and to catch any problems early on. So this is a broad thing. There are no amendments that are written yet, but this kind of comes from discussions with many of you, with many other members in this building there's tremendous interest in moving this process forward and planning for closure of the school. Yes, Representative Maurer.
Thanks.
Madam Chair, on the second page it says the funds are going to be held in trust.
Mm-hmm.
How trust are we going to hold the funds in?
That's a question that has come up frequently, and that is part of the discussion with Legislative Council, is how do you very, very carefully protect that trust. And obviously we are all very aware of that issue right now, and we will be writing this in a way that with an eye towards that.
Thank you.
Are there comments from the committee before? We've got a number of people, obviously, that are interested in talking about this issue, and we will be having several more conversations over the course of the next several weeks. Clearly, this is a big topic. It's a difficult topic, and it's a painful topic, and it's not a topic that should sit out there for months and months and months. This is something we'll be working on and making a final decision about before the end of April. So any comments from the committee?
One quick question.
Yes, Representative Harker.
Thank you. Sorry, I was shuffling papers trying to make sure I was on the right page here, and I think I missed when you said who formulated the planning principles here.
This is a compilation of the discussions that I've had with many of you and with other folks in the building and other folks in the community.
Okay, thanks.
Representative Huffman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'm sure I'll have a lot of comments. I appreciate this information, but I want to have a chance to digest it. So over the coming weeks, I'm sure we'll have some
absolutely
some good dialogue.
Representative Dembro.
Thanks, Madam Chair. I just want to say I appreciate the straightforward and open conversation that we've had so far and will continue to have. I think it's a tough subject, and we have to, we've heard from people, we have to continue to hear from people, and we just need to tackle it directly. Thank you.
Thank you, Representative Dembro. And that is certainly the goal, is to be very direct, to be very clear. This is not intended to have any secrecy around it. It's to be as open as possible. Anyone that is looking for information, please let us know. There's no desire to hold on to information and not share it. I think the one other thing I would ask before we start bringing people up to testify, I recognize, and I think all members of the committee recognize, that there are a lot of people that disagree strongly and passionately about this direction. And I know that we will hear that from you when you testify, and I hope that you will share that information because it's important to inform the discussion. But I would also ask you to help us in recognizing the juncture that we're at right now in this time in the history of the school. Because we're at this point of the school is going to move and be co-located with the School for the Deaf. And regardless of what this legislature does, that is the decision of the Superintendent of Public Instruction, and that decision has been made. Given that, after stating your opposition, to the degree that you can share with us your ideas about if there is a closure, how to make it better, and how to best protect the needs of this population of students and the students in the years to come, we need your help doing that the right way, and I hope that you will participate in that with the recognition that that is not your preferred, that that's not your preferred outcome at the end. Representative Van Orman.
Thank you. Just clarification, Madam Chair. So what we're talking about really is vacating the building, closing the building, and it does no longer function as a school. And the children have been transferred, as you said, elsewhere. And that's an independent decision that the superintendent could make. Is that correct?
No, the independent decision that the superintendent made, and the State Board of Education just upheld this appeal, was to basically vacate the facility at the School for the Blind,
right,
and then move everyone so that the School for the Blind and the School for the Deaf would share a campus on the School for the Deaf. So that's one discussion that's happening over there.
Right.
The discussion that we are having here, partly in light of that conversation, is vacating of the building and closing the building, but instead of building new facilities at the Oregon School for the Deaf to accommodate the Oregon School for the Blind, no longer having a state school for the blind, and instead reintegrating these students back into their local public schools and protecting the resources to continue serving those students and other students in future generations that experience the same disability.
Thank you.
Representative Harker.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just follow up to that. Does this body, does our committee and the legislature have the authority to say to the school, the Department of Education, rather than move to the deaf, School for the Deaf campus, transition these people back into their communities?
Yes, that would be a decision that the legislature would make.
Thank you.
So that
That would give us options. So an option could be, I think the other option, there's two options, one going over to the deaf and going to school, to the public school.
Correct.
Okay.
Thanks.
Thank you.
I think I got it.
Are there further questions or comments from the committee? Representative Huffman.
Just so that I can ask for information in case it's not in here, you're familiar with everything you gave to us, right?
Yes.
Most of the testimony we've heard has pretty much been compartmentalized. We heard from blind only,
mm-hmm.
We heard from deaf, and then when we toured the School of the Blind, we found out that, and I did see part of that in here, that a number of the students were multiple disabilities, blind and autistic or something else. Out in the, and I can't find the chart now, but there's a chart that tells how many visually or audibly impaired students are being handled out in their by their district or ESD, however that's handled. How many students are out in the state that have the multiple disabilities that we identified at School of the Blind that institution seems to be handling?
I don't have that number for you directly, but there are hundreds of those students out in local school districts.
Okay.
Even in my own school district, in my own son's special education classroom, there are several children who have multiple disabilities, and there is a child who has no functional vision in his classroom. Further comments from the panel before we take testimony? Representative Dimbrough.
Actually, I just have a clarifying question. So when we use the term multiply disabled, one of those disabilities will be visual disability.
Yes.
Is that right?
Yes. Yes. And that's in that document. You'll see this acronym. It's the B-VI-MD. It's the blind, visually impaired, multiply disabled. So we'll move to testimony. I would invite Janet Nelson, B.T. Kimbrough. Oh, is Representative Clem in the room?
Yes, he is.
Sorry, Representative Clem. And we've got a short amount of time and a large number of people, so I'm going to ask you to be brief so we can get to the citizens.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm Brian Clem, State Representative, District 21. Just to be clear, if it wasn't clear after my last visit, which I'm not sure it was, my district is on borders Mission Street. The School for the Blind is on the north side. My district is on the south side of Mission Street, and then about two blocks to the east is my district. So the buildings are 20 feet outside of my district. Most of the employees live in my district. It's in a neighborhood association that I reside in, the SCAN South Central Area Neighbors, that's in my district, but it's in Representative Berger's district, the actual buildings. So the first thing that would be really helpful for me is I believe there is some miscommunication between the department and the chair and me around the two choices, and the committee members need to know what the department's opinion is, because I've been told consistently every time that there are four choices. There is closure, which is what House Bill 2834 with the amendments when they get here would be, I think. Mm-hmm. There is co-locate, mm-hmm. which is a department decision that is completely dependent on passage of another bill, so you have to pass that bill or do a new bill that would let them keep the funds. That's the key issue. I've been told for 2 years now that if we don't get to keep the funds, there is no co-location. And I just confirmed it moments ago, and I've been told for 2 years that that is the issue. If you were told about an employer in your district that's about to be closed by a department or by other members, you would be upset too, that you had to find about a hearing on your own with amendments that I can't even look at. And then I hear that there is only two choices, co-locate or closure. The other is do nothing. Another one is pass the bonding bill to fix up the existing buildings. That's sitting in front of this legislature as well. So there are a lot of choices for your committee and this body, lots of them. I would also ask you to check with the independent board of directors. Instead of assuming that this program aligns with a lot of their goals, ask them. They're the ones who appealed co-location in the first place. Ask them what they think about closure. We appointed them for a reason, to be an independent board of directors. Just ask them if they want it closed. I don't know the answer, but I would ask them instead of assuming that the report aligns with their interests, because that might be true, but I would ask them about closure. I'd ask them about co-location. They're the independent board of directors. Ask them. There certainly is a tremendous interest in discussing what happens. I'm not sure there's a tremendous interest in moving forward with closure. Maybe there is. I don't know that that exists. No one's talked to me about a tremendous interest in closure. There had been co-location hearings where there was a tremendous interest in opposing that. There'll be a rally Saturday on the front steps of the Capitol about all this with several hundred people there, if anybody wants to attend with me. There's a tremendous interest in that, but I don't know if there's a tremendous interest in closure. The constitutional parameters that would need to be set up to prevent raiding of the trust are really important. Representative Howe, you're right. Constitutional protections for the trust. That's a ballot referral. So I would urge you to, if this bill, which I thought I was going to talk about study, I actually had some suggestions on how to change this bill to make it something I could support, but when I see amendments, I'll come back and talk to you about that. And in a down real estate market, is this the best time to be trying to surplus and sell state property? It's another question I would ask, since we're now talking about closure, and that means sale. So I do think the chair has tried to be as direct and clear and open as she can, but this is a gut and stuff of a bill about a study, and there's nobody here. I didn't even know about this hearing, and that until a reporter from my hometown paper said, what is this little asterisk about the amendments about possible closure? So I knew there was a path to closure. The chair's been very clear with me, there was a path. But I had like an hour and 20 minutes to notify people about this particular hearing, and the chair told me there would be more public hearings. So there will be more opportunities. I mean, I'm not trying to impugn the chair. It's just,
and the board of directors of the School for the Blind was notified about this last week, as was the Department of Education.
Yeah. So I know there will be more opportunities. I'm sorry if I'm a little worked up. But part of it is this is a very important issue to me, and I believe there are more options than just closure or co-location. I would like to see the bonding bill heard somewhere to fix up this property, to talk about how to have other agencies rent buildings to generate revenue to offset the cost of the program. I mean, there are other alternatives, and I would like to have a chance somewhere to weigh in on that. With that, I think I'll stop because I'm a little worked up and I feel kind of weird right now.
Well, thank you, Representative Clem. And thank you for raising something. I want to make an important clarification. I in no way want to suggest that the Board of Directors of the School for the Blind opposes any co-location or any closure. That is absolutely, bar none, totally clear. In terms of what some of these services are, and going through in the documents that were provided to us and that vision for what resources Birth to 21 should look like in a centralized kind of way across the state of Oregon, these were the types of things that were discussed that were very important to be getting out and providing to all students with blindness and visual impairment across the state.
Thank you for that clarification.
Are there any questions for Representative Clem? See none. Thank you very much for coming. It's always good to have you here. All right. So now, and thank you for your patience, Janet Nelson, B.T. Kimbrough, and Kathy O'Malley, please. Thank you and welcome. And of course, as you begin your comments, if you will state your name for the record, that would be very helpful.
Do you want me to go first, BT?
Yes.
I'm Kathy O'Malley, Madam Chair and Committee. I am a parent of a child that is currently in her second year at Oregon School for the Blind. I am in the North Clackamas School District in Clackamas County. I have had little notice to prepare for this, so I apologize. I do not have written notes to hand out, etc. Kelsey, my daughter, who is in attending right now at the school, has a great opportunity and it's a privilege to have her at OSB. Her brother, who is 23, did not have the privilege of attending the school. They both have retinitis pigmentosa. For those of you who are not aware of what RP is, if you could humor me by just taking your hands and putting them up to your eyes, and you have no peripheral, all you have is tunnel vision. That is what RP patients live with. Keegan, I'll talk about him briefly. The 23-year-old was a product of the public school system. Unfortunately, I was not aware of OSB at that time. It just became apparent to me in the last few years that, 2.5 years, that my kids did qualify for schooling at OSB. We sat through annual IEP meetings, being part of the team. I attended every IEP meeting. My husband did also. Not one time during the years was OSB brought up as an option for my son. He was diagnosed at about 8 years of age. Kelsey was diagnosed at 9. Annually during the IEP meetings, they would go through the routine paperwork as far as what options they had for school. And they were both in a classroom that was a special ed classroom. There were other visually impaired children there, children with various disabilities. Visual became a real problem maneuvering around the school. I believe, looking back over placement sheets, he received approximately 1 hour a month for consult throughout his elementary and junior high. It wasn't until the high school years that we screamed loud enough that we got a couple more hours of consultation and one-on-one using the cane, etc. Kelsey is doing great right now. I feel that she would have been further along than she is now had we had her down here at the program over the last 5-6 years. Several things, issues, and I'm sorry, I am nervous. I'm not a public speaker.
You're doing well.
I am so committed to this, and it just rips me apart to think that this is a program that you guys, as of today, is the first time I heard that you're even thinking of doing away with the program. Sending it to the local schools. I'm here to tell you the local schools, they don't get it. They never will get it. We, being parents of two kids, have always been strong advocates. It's lack of education, I believe, in the individual schools. As far as why in an IEP, it has never been mentioned. The only thing I can think of, a couple issues, is lack of ownership as far as the teacher, the regional assistants coming in, hating to admit that they just can't, you know, they just don't know how to deal with in such a short period of time. Whether it's a money situation, I know that I've been told from somebody outside of their school district that money is always brought to the teachers' attention as far as try to not mention or suggest that anything that's going to cost the district money be brought up, suggested as any additional item from the IEP for the students. I just think that these kids deserve an education just like a typical quote-unquote normal child would, and we are doing a disservice to all of these kids if we do any kind of altering of the program. One thing I will, in closing, would like to mention, as far as the hearings, I know there are parents that would like to speak. We have gotten very short notice of these hearings. Unfortunately, a lot of people live, you know, in excess of an hour away from Salem. It's hard to adjust their schedule. If there's any way we can have more of a notice of these hearings. Secondly, I would like the committee to address what they are doing with the 5-6 hours worth of the information that you have accumulated from people testifying, the handout that you just presented to us, is that your summary of what you have gotten out of everybody's testimony? Is that
is a summary of if there was going to be a closure, what would the elements need to be that would be part of that in order to best take care of the students that are there. That's not a summary of all of the testimony.
Okay.
People have the context of having heard
okay.
the testimony.
So
that
I guess
it's kind of a roadmap to look at how would we have this conversation.
So what I'd like to know then is what are we doing, what is the committee doing with the information that you are receiving from the board at OSB as well as other parents and other people testifying at these various hearings?
And I can share with you, if it's okay, on behalf of the committee. I know that in my office I have an enormous binder related to the Oregon School for the Blind that has my notes and the testimony that we received from everyone through the course of the week, the notes from the tour, notes from all the previous studies, the long-term plan and binder that came from the Board of Directors for the Oregon School for the Blind. All of those things are there and part of the discussion. And that's why it's been laid out. And later, if you could check in with the committee administrator, it's been hard to figure out how to contact people, and I know prior to the other hearing, I was trying to track down how to get to the parents and found someone's email address on the School for the Blind website and tried to send an email there in the week before those hearings. And in this one, tried to do it by contacting the Board of Directors. All of our hearings are always have notice requirements where it's 72 hours in advance for a first public hearing, 72 business day hours, and 48 hours. So I think this was posted last Wednesday afternoon because you left
Thursday, Friday.
But if you can give us who you'd like contacted, we can get you a schedule as things come out, because the goal is to be accessible, and which is why we had an evening hearing before so people could come.
Okay.
Thank you. All right.
Madam Chair?
Yes.
If I could interject, just so you know, because you haven't been at previous hearings, we did hear from, I don't remember how many, at least a parent that had said that they had sat through IEP meetings and over the years and never been told about School of the Blind. And so we have heard that before, and there were comments from the committee that, so that'll be discussed also.
So in follow up with that, just that thought, you know, population attendance is obviously not the greatest at OSB, but I can't help but think that there's got to be at least 100 more kids out there that would definitely benefit from the services, but somewhere trickle down from the state to the local school districts, the information is just not getting there.
All right.
And
we did discuss that. I'm going to have us move along. We have a lot of people signed up to testify and less than 24 minutes left in this hearing. So I'm going to ask the committee to hold their questions. Mr. Kimbrough.
Madam Chair, thank you very much. Members of the committee, staff, and guests, I'm Bradley Kimbrough. I serve as Vice Chair of the Advisory Board of the Oregon School for the Blind. The chairman of the board regrets that she was unable to be present today due to a previous commitment. I'm here to talk about the issue of closure of the Oregon School for the Blind. 2 years ago, the Oregon legislature created the advisory board for the Oregon School for the Blind with the specific mission of creating and continuously updating a five-year master plan for the school. Because OSB is a resource to many different groups of Oregonians, such a plan can't be derived overnight, since it's a blueprint for the transformation of the present school into the one that will be needed by the year 2014. In the process, a plan must be informed with the expectations of parents, teachers, students, alumni, and many others who play a part in the educational support system of blind and visually impaired students in Oregon. From the start, we heard from many quarters that this plan is very much needed and has been for a long time. In our contacts with stakeholders, we've probed and prodded for nearly 2 years, seeking information about how they view the school, whether it continues to have a role in the continuum of educational services in Oregon, and what that role is or what it should be. As most of you know, our board submitted the initial edition of the plan in late January. We hoped that the next step would be to create a task force to continue to develop the plan. Coincidentally, as everybody knows, there have been many years of debate about moving the School for the Blind to the much larger campus of the School for the Deaf and then selling the OSB campus. During a hearing of our appeal on this long-discussed proposal, the new OSB plan nevertheless was warmly welcomed by the Superintendent of Public Instruction and the members of the State Board of Education. We have every reason to believe that we'll have the full support of the Oregon Department of Education in the process of the task force that's described in our plan. When hearings of this committee on February 25th and 27th began with the chair's assertion that the choice before the committee was between co-location and the closing of the Oregon School for the Blind, members of the OSB board were shocked. In part, we were surprised because we've been in such close contact with many of OSB's stakeholders during the 2 years of our existence. Everyone wanted to see services to the state's visually impaired population become stronger. But no one had ever suggested that closing the school was the way to accomplish that. Perhaps we should not have been surprised that closure of OSB was proposed in the present economic environment. And yet, we've heard in previous hearings before this committee that what brings this to the table is not about dollars and cents. What then is the issue? If we assume that the highest human motivations apply, the drastic step of closing the school would not be evoked just because the school is vulnerable in that it's been talked about for so long as something that's going to be moved. If the highest human motivations apply, the real issue must be, what is the best way to deliver the educational services to which nearly 1,000 blind and visually impaired students in Oregon are entitled? That's certainly the intent behind the planning process I've described, in which the members of the OSB Advisory Board wholeheartedly believe. My purpose in being here today is to strongly urge this committee not to reverse the work of the 2007 General Assembly, not to undo the preliminary planning that's already been done, to redo it to match a particular agenda, not to end the decades of dedicated work in educated and training blind and visually impaired children at OSB, not to close the Oregon School for the Blind.
Thank you very much. Are there really quick questions for this panel? Seeing none, thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Next, I would have Lynn Shore and Catherine White.
I know it.
Lynn, please. Thank you.
Good afternoon. Thank you, Madam Chair and committee. My name is Lynn Shore, S-C-H-O-R-E. I am a resident of Portland. I have a second grader and a sixth grader in Portland Public Schools. I've been an Oregonian for half my life, 25 years, and this is my first time in the Capitol. So it shows you kind of how strongly I feel about this House bill that I'm here.
And Lynn, before you go too far, so we have your written testimony. I'm going to urge you to summarize it so we can get to everybody that's
sure,
on the list before the hearing. Thank you.
I'm going to just broad brush this. I've made for you a brochure, which we're going to be handing out at the rally, but I've made it for the representatives. This, just to broad brush what this is about, I do believe that downtown Salem is best for the education of blind and visually impaired students. That this public school site can best meet our educational and social needs because it combines a historic setting with supportive institutions and beautiful parks. And within blocks of OSB, students can build their orientation and mobility skills in accommodating park settings, museums, businesses, historic neighborhoods, and here on the mall. They are safer and healthier because of a well-maintained infrastructure here in Salem. And there are city sidewalks, crosswalks, street furniture, public restrooms and other things that will meet ADA guidelines for our students, and these amenities would be lacking for our students at the Oregon School for the Blind. The rest I will let you read. I'd like to get on to issues of land use, which I'm very concerned about. I've been, since I heard about the proposal just to merge, I really did not know about the closure, but I was I began to study the deeds, and I've been driving from Salem almost every day to study the deeds for these properties, for the Oregon School for the Blind, and I do believe that grave mistakes have been made by prior superintendents and this superintendent, and that no land use attorney has been hired to look at these deeds. I think it's very clear. I've looked at all the deeds from the Bushes, the Wilsons, the Cakes, the Spaldings, Henry Failing, who was the father of Portland Public Schools, and every one of them has this language. And by the way, this is the last time they tried to close the school. When we had proper notice, our community was able to put together two books of this size. And these are just an overview of records and documents from the last time they tried to close the Oregon School for the Blind. There have been 17 attempts over 19 years, I believe. I lost my page. Well, what this
I'm going to ask you to summarize, not okay, because we don't want to hear just, you, but we're just right, running out
all
of
right,
time.
All right. Why has the OSB, I have a number of questions. Why has the OSB property not been properly maintained? Has DOE requested funding for maintaining these properties? And if so, why were funds not provided to the extent that school improvements are now compromised? It is acknowledged that land can last 2 billion years while a structure has an expected life of 50 to 100 years or much longer. I think we all know you can get a great education in an old building or there wouldn't be Oxford, Harvard, Yale, Reed. The age of the building has nothing to do with the education that you get there. I would pose that the condition of the physical facility has no bearing on the underlying value of the land to our citizenry, and thus there's no compelling need to sell public land at all, even if the facility has been neglected. If an agency's political goal or a director's agenda is to provide employment for or real estate for consultants or development interests, the agency may let the property fall into disrepair. Then the agency obtains evaluations performed by disinterested third-party consultants who can and do benefit from redevelopment of the land. The removal of these facilities and these improvements will provide for funds for the development interests in both locations, the old school and the new. Task forces, studies, reports, design, engineering, and architectural services will be required to the detriment of the public treasury. To many, this appears as plunder or greed, as these are our public assets and they are being sold to benefit private parties. In the instance of the OSB and OSD, the Center for Innovative School Facilities is leading the movement for school closure. The Center for Innovative School Facilities stated goal is to create revenue from our public assets. And in Portland, the same group, I have documents from them, which I can show you, that state that they called our schools pigs, and they stated that they didn't know which of our pigs were going to be made into sow's ears and which of our pigs were going to be made into bacon. And I will send you that document.
I can just clarify for you, until this moment, I have never heard of the Center for Innovative School Facilities. So in terms of this discussion, it would not be accurate to say that they were leading this discussion. I've not heard from them, discuss them, or
Superintendent Castillo of the Department of Education. I have the one-page brochure. She is on the advisory committee, and she says that these five members of I have the document. I will pass it to
Thank
your clerk.
You. I'm going to ask you to summarize.
Okay,
please.
So to finalize, I believe that man can live by his labor and the application of his labor, and that process is the origin of property. But there are others who will live by trying to seize and consume the products of others. This school, the Oregon School for the Blind, was deeded to our deaf students, is the original deed in Oregon, and to all Oregonians. And the deed, in conclusion, I will read you what every deed says. It says, to have and to hold the said premises with their appurtenances unto the said board of directors of the Oregon School for the Education of Deaf Mutes, their successors, and their assigns forever. So, I know I'm not an educator and I'm not a land use lawyer, but I know what forever means, and it means forever, and this school should remain in the public holdings forever. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Catherine White, please.
Madam Chair, members of the committee, my name is Catherine White, and I'm here on behalf of the Oregon Council on Developmental Disabilities, which is a federally funded, governor-appointed council that is charged with doing system analysis and promoting system change. We have advocated on special education issues for many, many years, and I will make my comments very, very brief, and they are specific to the School for the Blind and not to the School for the Deaf. I served on a work group a number of years ago. We've watched this issue for many years. I served on a work group a number of years ago that reviewed the status of the School for the Blind, and we had the opportunity to literally get into the weeds, look at the demographics, look at the funding, look at the population, look at the geographic diversity, look at the curriculum, do the whole review of the school. What the committee struggled with was the educational justification for residential supports, for a residential program. What was the educational justification for a residential program? Particularly in light of the context that we were talking about, a small number of students, 30 students versus over 800 students who are served in local school districts. We talked about it in the context of other disabilities. As you may know, that to get residential placement funded through the school or educational setting is very, very unusual and is usually the result of extensive litigation. And so we struggled to try and come up with an educational reason that students with vision impairments alone should be entitled to residential funding. And it was a struggle. What we did, and we were actually unable to come up with that kind of an explanation. In addition, the council spoke to a number of families who had children in the School for the Blind over the years, and they told us a number of things. One, their children had multiple disabilities. Two, they did not feel that their educational supports were adequate. However, if given more intensive services and technical assistance, they believed that it would be highly preferable that their children would be in their own communities benefiting from being a part of their local school district and staying within their family homes. And three, and this was particularly important, many of the children who attended the School for the Blind, their parents struggled to provide the 24/7 services for them. They were there not because they had a vision impairment. They were there because they had autism. They were there because they had significant cerebral palsy. They were there because they required 24/7 services. One of the challenges we have in Oregon is really inadequate support that integrates both what is done in school with what occurs in the family home.
Justin, I'm going to have to ask you to summarize.
I'm going to summarize. We do not support disability-specific residential placements. Fairview was a disability-specific residential placement for children, and it was closed down. A number of years ago, we had legislation in this building to create a school for autism. Lots of justification. Lots of states have school for autism. We said we were going to invest in our local school districts and invest in support to families. We simply do not support disability-specific residential programs funded out of education, aside from the School for the Deaf, and I'm not commenting on that.
Okay. Thank you. Are there any really quick questions for either of these individuals? No? Thank you very much. Next we have Art Stevenson and Janet Nelson.
Yes.
And I'm going to apologize and urge you to be brief. The next committee will be in here, and that chair will kick us out.
Okay. I'll be real quick, you guys, because you've all talked to me and you know who I am. I'm Art Stevenson, the president of the National Federation of the Blind of Oregon. And again, go right across the river and see a well-working regional program and a school for the blind. You have children out there that are graduating at 18 instead of 21. They're becoming very, very viable people out in the real world and getting jobs. Right now, the blindness community throughout this country has a 70% unemployment rate. 70%. You take away the school for the blind, you're just going to make it worse. You need to develop a good regional program and a good school for the blind, and then these kids will be getting the education that they deserve. And my forefathers would be rolling over in their graves if they knew we were going to get rid of this historic site on our 150th birthday. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Stevenson. Was Janet Nelson here?
I'm sorry, I'm new at this. I guess I shouldn't have signed in.
Okay.
Well, you're welcome.
Okay. Oh, I see that. Thank you. I'm sorry to
keep on.
We're out of time. Is there anyone else? We don't have time to hear anybody else today. We've gotten through everyone that signed up. I want to make sure that you get copies of agendas when they come out and that you know when this is happening. So, Kevin, can you...
If you go to the members of the committee, Chair Gelser, if you go to the website, the legislative website, and I would encourage all of you to please do so because I know there's a lot of interest out there, and probably the best mechanism for getting the word out is going to be going to the website. There is an automatic subscription function that if you go to the homepage of the website, down along the right-hand side, there is, I believe it's an e-subscribe. There's a little envelope.
Kevin?
Yeah.
Can I suggest a different idea?
Yes, indeed.
If you write down your email address and hand it to me now, I will put you on that and you will receive them. But if you give that to me, you're giving me permission to sign you up to get agendas from this committee.
And for anyone else out there, you can go, who's not here, who can't give the subscription, just to let you know, there is the e-subscribe. Just follow the instructions, and you'll be put on the list, and automatically you will receive an email, the posting for the Education Committee. So.
So thank you all very much. With that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2834, and I'm going to adjourn the House Committee on Education.
Has no